We are studying in the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 3 and 4 today. So if you have your Bibles or you have your iPad or iPhone, turn to Nehemiah chapter 3. This is one of the tougher chapters in the entire Bible because there are 40 names that are unpronounceable in it. So I thought to save my marriage, I would not have Elizabeth come up and read this today. Now, you need to know, when you read the Bible, there are times to read it aloud. When you read the Psalms, and you read Proverbs, and you read the passages Elizabeth reads, and there are also times to read the Bible silently. Nehemiah chapter 3 is a time to read the Bible silently. Then you're not embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed, but it is so good. And what we tend to do is when we get to a Nehemiah chapter 3 is we skip it, and we go Nehemiah 1, 2, 4. It's like, is that ridiculous? There's even a commentary from someone you know who's very famous who skipped the entire chapter 3. He didn't even want to deal with it because there's so many names in it. Well, we're going to look a little bit at it in just a moment. But before we do, I just want to get us thinking, because as you look at Nehemiah, there's so many ways you can study Nehemiah. You can study his leadership. You can study the coming back of the Jewish people called back to their homeland. There's just so many ways to look at it. One of them is prayer. And I think it's interesting that I've been studying Nehemiah for probably 15 years, and I teach it about once every 3 or 4 years. And this time I've really looked at it through the eyes of how Nehemiah deals in prayer. And so today we're going to look at that as we look at chapters 3 and 4. Why is that important? Because, well, let me give you an example. There was a great piano player, concert piano player from Europe back about 100 years ago, whose name was Ignacy Paderewski. Say that twice. I can barely say it. Ignacy Paderewski. We may not know who he is, but he was one of the most famous piano players in the world, and he was hired by his government, who said, we want you to play concerts throughout the land. He was Polish, and so do that. He said, I'll do it under one condition, that you pay me to practice my scales. Does anybody play the piano? Do you know they teach you when you're just starting to play piano to play scales? It is without a doubt the worst part of piano playing. And I think that's why I started quitting piano in about 3rd or 4th grade. And I still play the piano today, but I play it like a 2nd grader. Why? Because I didn't move forward with my scales. I didn't really understand this until one day when we hired Clay and he was here, and I got here early on a Sunday morning and we prayed, the elders out back and in one of the rooms, and I was walking up. Nobody was in this room except Clay, and he was playing his scales. On Sunday morning, I thought, Clay, Sunday morning's not the time to play scales. And I went to him, I said, why? He said, because I have to be prepared to play the real music. And so Paderewski, when the people asked him, said, why? He said, because if I don't practice my scales for a day or two, I will notice it. He said, if I don't practice my scales for another couple of days, my coach will notice it. And he says, if I don't practice it for a couple of more days, the world will notice it. And that is really where prayer is. Prayer is a connection. And you know what? You can live today without praying. No doubt about it. Don't pray today. You will survive till tomorrow. No doubt about it. But your spiritual life will be affected by it. And it may not show up. I may not be able to tell. Your wife or husband may not be able to tell your friends. But you don't pray and you don't connect with God for a period of time, and it will affect your life. And so we see this in Nehemiah. So let's turn to chapter 3 of Nehemiah. And we're going to move in, because now with Nehemiah, we're moving into the working part of Nehemiah. So I'll just give you a quick synopsis of chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the people have connected together. Nehemiah has assessed the situation, which we looked at in chapter 2 last week. So chapter 2, we've studied the situation. He knows. Now, just to think about it, it doesn't say it, but when you add it all up, it's about 2.5 miles of wall that needs to be rebuilt. 2.5 miles of wall that needs to be rebuilt. 7 or eight gates need to be rebuilt. And again, these gates are not little doors. These gates are big enough to bring in camels and cattle and hordes of people. These are huge gates with those huge swinging doors with a lot of wood, a lot of mechanical aspects to them. They all have to be started from scratch because there's not even the casements to put them in. So they got to build the casements, build the wall around it, and put those eight gates in it. And so Nehemiah starts assigning the jobs. And through Nehemiah chapter 3, you see 40 assignments of jobs. You guys do this from here to there. You guys do that from here to there. You guys do this gate. You guys do that gate. You guys go from here to there. And he begins to describe it. Now, a couple thoughts out of this just so you can get it. The first one is he went to a group called the Tekoites, and they were all excited about doing it, except their leaders, he calls them their nobles, refused to do the work. They stopped. There's only one group. He asked all the families, all the clans, all the tribes of Judah and the Jews, and the Tekoites said, we are not going to do it. And so they didn't. Sometimes God calls people to do things, and they choose not to do it, and they didn't do it. And it was an embarrassment, we find out later, from the other Tekoites, because they wanted to do it and be known to do it, but there was a certain group of their people that just said, we're not going to do it. It wasn't just men who built it. There were women, there were children, and it wasn't just builder men, builder women. There were goldsmiths, perfumers. These are people that worked with botanicals to make perfumes and things like that. They were building. All these people, young and old, were building this wall, and we see this coming. And then, as we heard last week, and we see, there's a lot of people that start harassing them. There's this opposition that comes, and that's really part of chapter 2, part of chapter 3, and most of chapter 4, there's an opposition that comes. Now, I want to look at these first four chapters, review a little in chapter 1 and 2, and then look at 3 and 4 from prayer. Can we do that? So, let me ask you, let me put up here the relationships that we see in these four chapters. There's Nehemiah, of course, the man. It's called the Book of Nehemiah. We're talking about the man, Nehemiah. So, four relations that Nehemiah had. In chapter 1, we see that Nehemiah had a relationship with God. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Chapter 2, he had a relationship with the king, with his boss. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. In chapter 3, he had a relationship with the people, the children of Israel, the people around Judah, and all the ones, and they're named, again, 40 names. It's actually more than 40 names of people and tribes and clans that he has relationships with. And pretty much all but one come together. It's a great study in teamwork and leadership, but we're not going to look at that. That's chapter 3. And then in chapter 4, actually more than chapter 4, but chapter 4, it solidifies, and that's the opposition. And he has a relationship with the opposition. And all of this connects with prayer. So let me give you something to write down about prayer, if I could. Prayer does not release us from responsibility. I'm not seeing anybody write down. Write that down. Because here's what I want to dispel for a moment. The concept of let go, let God. Have you ever heard that? Let go, let God. There are rare occasions that you should do that. Rare occasions that you should do that. But when we look in the Bible, we see the people of the Bible connecting with God and still doing what they were responsible for doing. It's not like, okay, God, I'm going to pray for you. You now do this. I'm going to go over here and do what I want to do. God calls them to do certain things. They pray and interact, and prayer does not release them from that responsibility. Let us be clear that if God has called you to do something, don't think that prayer releases you from that responsibility. Now, certainly there are things you can't do that you can do in prayer. If you got friends in California and you've haven't seen them in a while and you want to pray for them, pray for them and pray that God brings other people to them. And maybe your responsibility is just to pray for them. That's good. But most of the time we go, let God do it. I'm just going to let go of it. And you got to deal with it. And that even means your own things like fear. You know, let go. Well, God had him do something with his fear last week. But so what is prayer? Rather, it inspires us and galvanizes, and I use that word galvanize for a purpose, big word. It galvanizes our resolve. When God has called us to do something, we're going to look at this in a minute, it inspires us. We should realize that our relationship with the Almighty is a two-way relationship. Reading the scriptures, praying, it's a two-way street here with God, and there is a sense of inspiration. I know that's an old word, but spire means breathe. Expire, inspire, in, out. It's an old way of saying that you are inspired, small I, we're not inspired by, you know, like writing the scriptures, but we're inspired by what God has given us to do. Prayer gives you a strength that you don't have when you don't pray. But the second thing it does is it galvanizes. Does anybody know what the word galvanize means? I know there are scientists in here who exactly know what it means. I'm not a scientist, but I'm going to tell you what it means from a lay person's side. And I know someone's going to come up and correct my exact wording on this. But here's what it is. 200 years ago in the 1830s, they were using iron to build buildings and structures and some copper and other things, and it was rusting, and it was decomposing. They were using it in roof systems and other types of systems, and so they figured out a way through electrical whatever to fuse together zinc, another substance, onto iron and galvanize the iron so that it could withstand water, salt, other elements, whether it was hot elements or cold elements in a thing, and it would last much longer because it was galvanized with zinc. Now they use other polymers now to galvanize metal, but back then it was. And if you go to the third world today and you look at roof systems in villages, they'll talk about zinc roofs. Now they're not technically zinc roofs, but they've been galvanized with zinc so that they will withstand the water, rust, snow, whatever the case may be. There's a galvanizing. So we have taken the word galvanize to mean strengthen. When you galvanize metal, zinc into metal, it strengthens it. When you galvanize your life with prayer, it strengthens you so that you have resolve to do whatever God has called you to do. So in a roof system, it is to protect you from the water. That's what it is galvanized to do. Or in walls, for us, prayer galvanizes us. It's an incredible visual aid to understand that. So prayer does not release us from responsibility. Rather, it inspires us. That's the positive side. And it protects us and the resolve God has given us to do the work he has called us to do. He has not just said, pray and hope that it works. Now let's look at this in all four chapters if we could. So chapter number one, the first prayer in Nehemiah is that prayer in chapter one we talked about 2 weeks ago. You remember the prayer? It was long, very detailed. It was a prayer about thanking God, praising God, showing your awe for God, and then asking God for something. He asked, and this prayer lasted, or a prayer like this, lasted for months. Well, what did it lead to? When we talk about inspired and galvanizing and resolve, it led Nehemiah to strong planning and preparation. The rest of Nehemiah would not make sense if Nehemiah had not spent 4 months praying and preparing. being inspired by God to do the work God had called him to do, and then being resolved to do that work, which meant he had to prepare. And we spent a lot of time talking about the preparation that he did. This is a long prayer. These are the very detailed prayers. Many of us have prayer journals, prayer books, prayer things that we use where we ask God certain things over and over again, and we're preparing and we're praying and we're asking God to help us do certain things. That is this kind of prayer, and Nehemiah had it, long, detailed. But there was a second prayer in chapter 2 that we talked about last week, which was silent and short. I mean, it may have lasted 3 seconds. First prayer was a series of prayers that lasted 4 months. And how many of us have prayed for months and months, maybe even years for a certain thing? Have you ever done that? Yes, you have, haven't you? But there is a time for a short prayer. There is a time where you don't have the time to pray long prayers. And here was Nehemiah. This was chapter 2. We talked about it last week. Nehemiah's there. The king goes, "Boy, you don't look good today." "Well, I'm saddened by the condition of my homeland and all that's happened in the fatherland." And he was afraid because the king said, "Well, what should we do? Talk to me." And he was afraid. And in that fear, he prayed. It was silent. It was short because the conversation continued. And I hope you know that if you do long prayers and you have a relationship with God, you can certainly do the short prayers. A lot of people do short prayers without the long prayers. They want to play like Pederoski, but they don't want to practice like him. I sit here at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning every once in a while going, "I wish I could play like Clay." Have you ever done that? I love piano, so for me, I watch his fingers. I go, "I wish I could play like that." Hello, if I practiced like he could, does, and did all his life for 10,000 hours, maybe I could. But he can just walk up and I'll go, "Clay, will you play such and such?" That fast, he's like clipping it away. Why? Because he's done all the other work. I could stand up here or sit at the piano and try to play that, and it would be horrendous because I haven't done the hard work of the relationship with me to the piano. And we sometimes have not done the hard work of the relationship with us to God. And by hard, I mean extensive. God wants that relationship with us. So in chapter 2, he's like all afraid, and Nehemiah, and he just prays a short prayer, and we know the result. The result is that God gave him the immediate strength to handle the conversation with the king, the emperor, the one who could kill him had he said the wrong things. The one who could said no had he said the wrong things. And this short, silent prayer dispelled fear. And he just moved right forward into it. Now, that was all the last couple of weeks. Let's go to number 3, which brings us to today. And let's go to chapter 4 and start reading where I can read again. So you're going to have to read chapter 3 on your own. But they're building the wall. Chapter 3 is the beginning of the building of the wall. 40 groups of people, 2.5 miles long, and it's not a straight line. It's actually multiple curves and a couple right angles, so they can't even see each other. Piles of rubble everywhere, and now we pick up the story, and we're going to look at 2 other ways Nehemiah prayed. Now when Sanballat, verse 1 of chapter 4, heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers in the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones of that?" Then Tobiah, who we talked about last week, the Ammonite, the traitor, was beside him, and he said these words, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their walls." There's this demoralization that's going on with these opposers to not just Nehemiah, that was chapter 2, but now we're in chapter 4, he's doing it to all the people. So he's sending out people to your section of the wall going, guys, ladies, this is not working. Actually, he said far worse things and probably curses in the middle of it, whatever, however they cursed back then. And they're doing all these things so to discourage all those people. Hundreds and hundreds of people representing thousands and thousands of people, and they're hurling these insults to the people. So what does Nehemiah do? He prays. This is a different prayer. He prays to strengthen the people. Now, he's been strengthened in the opposition, whether it was the king just to come, whether it was the job, the opposition of not having the right resources, or the opposition of Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. Now the people are being opposed, so he prays to strengthen the people. What does he pray? Verse 4, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to the plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." Now, I'm a very positive guy, so I put this prayer is to strengthen the people. What I actually have in my notes, and I wasn't going to tell you, is this is a prayer of complaint. Nehemiah is complaining to God. Have you ever complained to God? Okay, so we have, so let's just get it out. Every once in a while, you're going to pray a prayer of complaint. Why is this person doing this? Why are these circumstances happening to me? He is praying complaints. That's the negative side. What he's doing, though, is strengthening the people. It's a prayer to strengthen the people because he prays this out loud. I'm sure he's prayed it multiple times, praying it among the people to encourage them, and they're probably praying with him. And what happens? It leads to the building of the wall. Verse 6. So we built the wall. It doesn't say, so we responded to the complaints, so we opposed the opposers. It doesn't say any of that. It says, so we built the wall. And it does it in a great way. And all the wall was joined together to half its height. We don't get that. Read it again. So all the wall, that's 2.5 miles. There's no bulldozers. There's no elephants. There's no ability for camels to help because they can't get through all this. This is human beings building this. And it's all connected halfway up already. And they're continuing to build it. And then underline this last half of verse 6. For the people had a mind to work. The people had a mind to work. How many of you come out of a British Commonwealth country? Raise your hand. There's a lot. Raise your hand. Don't be embarrassed. There are hundreds in this congregation that are from Africa, the Caribbean, Western Europe, other parts of Eastern Asia that have a British, you go, why do you care about the British? Well, they know what the word mind means. See, we think mind means this, and it does, think mind. They had a mind. Mind means, in the British context, to do it, to be careful as you do it, to watch what you do it. And my wife would, when we first got married, she would say something like, if I was about to trip or to touch something that was high, she would go, mind it. Well, what on earth does that mean? Mind it. I'm like, mind it means be ready, be resolved to it. Does anybody know this? Those of you from British context know this. Even so, if you've ever been to England, one of the great modern wonders of the last 150 years is the English or the British Underground in London, the tube. Has anybody ridden the tube in London? What do they say every time you get on it? Mind the gap. I first got, what is on earth mind the gap mean? Think about the gap. What it means is that in the 1880s, when they built that, it's a series of 6 railroad systems underground. Those railroad systems were not connected initially until they built escalators and elevators and different things so you could go from one system to another. That's why sometimes you go down three sets of escalators to get to one, sometimes you go down one, and sometimes it's even above ground. So you have the green line and the blue line and the yellow line and the pink line and the red line and all these lines. And one day about 30 years ago, 40 years ago now in the 1960s, they wanted to connect them all together. And they realized they couldn't because they were all different size trains with different size platforms. So they want to unify the train system, but the platforms were all different heights for the different trains from the last 100 years. So they said, this will break our country. And some guy said, why don't we just tell people to watch their step? And that's what they did. And they did a big campaign, and I would have said, watch your step. That's the American way. Their way of saying was mind the gap. And mind the gap means both, you got to look forward and you got to look backwards, because many people are rolling their suitcase onto it. So you got to look forward to watch the step, but you got to also realize you're carrying things with you, and that needs to mind the gap as well, whether it's going down or up or separate. Mind is an incredible word, far beyond just think about it. It's actually as you are walking, as you are working, that you are resolved to do it. And they had a mind to work, and these people were not going to stop them. They could play, if I could use a play on words, they could do any mind games they wanted to do. The foxes would cause this, it's so bad, to fall over. None of that happened because they were of a position and of a resolve to do the work God had called them to do. That's what that prayer was about. The prayer was not just to complain, which it was, but to strengthen us to do the work God has called us to do. And I would encourage you, as you pray, you're praying prayers, asking, thanking God for all he does. That's a part of what we do when we sing here. Praying prayers to get us out of bad situations. That's that short prayer, God help me. But then there's also prayers to encourage us to continue the work as we are doing it. And that was this prayer. Then there's a fourth prayer, and that starts in verse 7. It's actually in verse 9, but I'll continue to read. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, now the group of opposers is growing. It was originally just Sanballat and Tobiah. Then they added the Arabs, Geshem the Arabs, and now we're adding other Ammonites. And now the Ashdodites, not important who they are, except that they're groups of people. They heard the repairing of the walls was going forward after all this harassment, that the breaches were beginning to be closed, and they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. Verse 9, and we prayed to our God. This is important. I'm going to get to the prayer in just a moment. And we prayed to our God. Sometimes there comes a point in your life and in your work and in your ministry and in the things God has called you to do where the noise gets so loud, the opposition, we're failing, things like that, that you just don't get it. That there begins to become discouragement. And the teams were beginning to be discouraged. There's a lady in America about 60 years ago in the 1950s. Her name was Florence Chitworth or Chitwin or something like that. And she was a swimmer, long-distance swimmer. She's the first lady to swim both sides of the English Channel from Dover to Calais, and then Calais back to Dover. She's the first woman to swim the Dardanelles, the Bosphorus, Gibraltar, and she wanted to be the first woman to swim between Catalina Island in California into Dana Point in California into the mainland. So she got up, and as always, they had a little boat there. Usually her mother was with her in the boat, cheering her on, and she started the swim. And as she's starting to swim, she was making it. It was getting rough. It was getting tough. And then the worst thing came in for a swimmer. Fog rolled in. So now she's swimming in what is, in essence, darkness. It wasn't dark, but she couldn't see where she was going. So her mother is cheering her on. And all this, the waves, the noise of the engine, the fog, her own fears were all coming together so that she stopped listening to her mother. Her mother's in a boat. The boat's elevated ever so slightly so that she's seeing above the low part of the fog. Her mother knew she was within a half a mile of the shore. Half a mile. I could swim the half a mile. You could swim the half a mile. This lady, the best swimmer, long-distance swimmer in the world, is a half a mile from making a world record. And she stopped swimming and got into the boat. And her mother, who now she could listen to and chose to listen to, said, "You're only a half a mile from shore. But once you get in the boat, it's over. Once you touch the boat, it's over. You can't touch the boat." She gets in the boat, and she said, "If I knew it was a half a mile, I would have stayed and swum the rest of the way." You see, she got so discouraged because she stopped listening to her mother because of all the things that were around her. Her own mind starts working, the fog, the noise, the waves crashing over her head, and she stopped swimming. And what I find is there are Christians who do the same thing. They stop listening and communicating with God, and they listen and hear all the other things and realizing that God sees the future. God sees where they're heading. God sees the point that they need to go to, even when you and I cannot see it. And my encouragement with you is to move forward. And this is the last prayer. And this prayer is a prayer for protection against those things. Against those things. Now, this is a physical opposition. And here's what he prays. "And we pray to our God," verse 9, "and set a guard as a protection against them day and night." Now, they had physical issues because now they're physically being accosted. There are physical things happen. They're starting to destroy the work of the day at nighttime, and we find out that they continue work 24 hours a day, that half the people are guarding, half the people are working. They actually kept their swords by their sides. There are people doing all this guarding to guard against the opposition. Now, we're physically not building a wall. We're physically not hammering nails and putting together stones and hewing the stones so they can be balanced. We're doing none of that physically. But this is a spiritual application right now. Let's bring this thought, 400 BC? So let's bring it 2,500 years forward. And the opposition, we need to pray. And what kind of guards are we putting around us to help us do what God has called us to do? So that what God has called us to do can continue. And can I just say, I'm going to make a statement here, and it's not political. It's a personal statement. Our vice president came out and said that he has personal standards about how he works and treats women. Did you see that this week? And he was mocked for doing that. Mocked for setting up some guards so that he treats women with respect. And he was mocked for that. And as I was reading some of his list, it's called the Billy Graham list, I thought, boy, I do some of those things too. That's kind of what I, you know, and you're going to get mocked for some of the things you do, even to guard against some bad things. We are being mocked for being for good things. Now, we should be mocked for doing bad things. There are things Christians do in this country that are stupid, and okay, we deserve getting mocked. But when we're doing good things, And I'm not speaking politically here. I'm just talking about his personal morality at this point in time. He has a personal morality that he has a high view of women, and he wants to keep that, and now he's getting harassed for it. But I am praying for him that he will continue setting a guard in his life so that he can continue doing the job God has called him to do. Now, that is a very particular thing that was in the news this week. What are the things you need to do in your life that you need to pray for that guard the opposition in your life so that you can do what God has called you to do? And that is specific to every single one of us, because what I need to be guarded towards is different than what you need to be guarded towards. So the example of the wall is a great example, whatever, but I'm not going to say you need this because I need that, or because I'm maybe not bothered by certain things, but I'm bothered by other things. Maybe certain sins don't entice me, other sins entice me. So I'm not going to sit here and rail against one sin, because I'll probably rail against a sin that doesn't entice me. And then I'll look like I'm good, when the reality is every one of us have enticing sins that surround us. You have to admit that. I hope you know that, and all of you are of an age that should know what your besetting sins are. What are the sins that so easily entangle you, which may not be the ones that entangle them over there? Doesn't mean they're better than you. It just means that they got other sins to deal with. And God is calling us, and I would suggest and propose to you that prayer is a way to combat this in a positive way. It's a great way to have a better relationship with God, a great way to fully understand your personal relationships like Nehemiah had with the king. It's a great way to encourage people around you as Nehemiah did with the people, and it's a great way to go against the opposition. Whether the opposition are people, or the opposition are sins, or the opposition are things that take away your interest in the Lord, please understand that. And prayer is a way to do that. Prayer is not there to excuse us and to take the responsibility of the way. It's there to inspire us and galvanize us to move forward. So do you believe that? Is that something that you believe in? Praying. That's why Clay calls us to pray every week. We have prayer people here every week. We want to assist you. I can't pray for you. I mean, I can pray for you, but I can't make you pray. There's nothing I can do to make you pray. I can't put a gun to your head and say, you got to pray. So I am here to encourage you incredible things. And can I just say, here's the thing that matters. It's not there, but it's elsewhere. Is that when you pray, you will become a changed person. Yes, when you pray, you'll be more organized, better relationship to God, you'll be better with people, all these things, but you will be a changed person. I made a commitment a couple months ago to a group of people that I would pray for them, 12 people. I said, every week, I'm going to pray for you. And then I thought, oh my goodness, do you know what responsibility that is? That every week I'm going to pray for these people for specific things, very specific things, and I committed to do it. I told them I would do it, and so I met with a couple of those 12 people the other day, and I said, you know, my life has changed because I'm praying for you. My life has just been transformed. I do it at the same time every week, and that's one of my favorite hours of the week because I'm not looking to myself. I'm looking to others, I'm looking to God to bless others, and I'm like blessed out of my mind. It is one of the best hours I have in a week, is that hour. I do it at the same time because I'm one of those OCD, do everything at the same time of the week kind of people, and you know who you are. And so I do it at the same time every week, because if I don't, I'll forget. And so I actually schedule it, and I'm a changed person because of it. So prayer is not just for me to help change other things, other people, other events, or change the mind of God. Prayer is so that I get changed and to help me walk through my life and your life as well. Let's close, and I just want to share a last story. I love going to cities around the world. I mentioned London today. I love it. One of my favorite places is Saigon, Vietnam. It's called Ho Chi Minh now, but I still call it Saigon. How many of you were in and around the Vietnam War? If you served in the Vietnam, raise your hand, or in and around that. Raise your hand. Yeah, there were several. I was too young. The Vietnam War was over, but I grew up with that. That was the first television war we had, and I grew up with that whole thing. And so I always wanted to go. In fact, my dad tried to take us there in the 70s during the war, but it didn't work out. So I got there, been there twice. One thing about Saigon, and every city is different, this is, and I think we have some Vietnamese people here today, but Saigon is a great town. There are 2.5 million motorcycles in Saigon. 2.5 million motorcycles. So when you come up to a light, if you're standing on the sidewalk, let's say it's a 4-lane or a 3-lane road, there could be 400 motorcycles there. And they're not in order, 1 or 2, and then 2 and 2 and 2. There's 50, and then 50, and the wheeling is halfway. I mean, it's just the most unbelievable thing. And then the light turns green, and then it all breaks loose. And most places in Saigon, there are no lights. So it's always breaking loose. So how do you cross the street in Saigon? Because they have beautiful streets. It's a gorgeous city, the downtown. French, provincial, it's a gorgeous city. Beautiful buildings, downtown. And so how do you cross the street? It's impossible to cross the street. Impossible. And so I asked somebody, how do you cross the street? And it was interesting, as I was asking this person, there was an older lady down the way, and she had a cart carrying her groceries with one of those small little carts to go to her home. And she goes, watch her, she's going to cross the street. I said, this lady's going to get killed. Older, probably in her 80s, hunched over. She crossed the street and didn't get touched. I said, that's impossible. I just watched it. He goes, now you try it. I said, I'm not going to try it. So I saw another person, an older person. I said, what if I just follow that person? And I did. It was just amazing. I just got right kind of in their wind and just kind of drafted my way across. He said, and he came across a different way and laughed at me. He said, this is what you got to do. You got to pick your spot across the street. And once you pick your spot, just keep walking. And they will all miss you. The moment you stutter with your step, you'll be hit by 20 motorcycles all at once. Stuttering as you cross causes you to at least fall and get hit by one, but once you fall, you're just gonna get run over. He goes, pick your spot, walk at any cadence you want, but make sure you have your spot and don't change it. And for the week I was there, I did that, and never, I felt the motorcycles, I saw the motorcycles. I think that's what prayer is. If you're looking at Jesus Christ, some people can go faster than other people. Some people are just good at growing closer to Christ, quicker to Christ. That's not the important thing. The important thing is that you're heading in the right direction and that you're moving forward. And while you're in the midst of this world, that is not the time to fall or to stutter or to jerk, because you've got to know what you're doing and walk, whether you're a little old lady pushing your groceries home, just going ever so slowly, or a young person that's choosing to run across the street. I don't know what your spiritual aptitude is, your spiritual strength is, but all of us need to head towards Jesus Christ. And as we do, let us do it in a cadence so that we are not getting tripped or tripping ourselves. And that, I believe, my friends, is what prayer does. Prayer aligns us with God. And in that alignment, whether you're praying long prayers, short prayers, quick prayers, prayers for opposition, prayers for your brothers and sisters, whatever it is, it keeps your focus on the listener of those prayers, which is not me, it's him, is it not? Can you do that? Can you say, I want to pray more? Not just so you can be holier, you can run across the street faster. It's not about running across the street as fast as you can run, but it's part heading in the right direction. Let's pray together.